You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
Michigan lost 170,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years. All of these factors are the effects of something.
There are all kinds of things that are put out here to try to convince us that the easiest thing to do is to suffer. In one city, in Detroit, Michigan, the water department disconnected service at 40,752 addresses.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the show. The auto industry of Detroit, Michigan reflects the death of industrialization. With the increased use of the microchip and the ever-expanding global market, thousands of jobs have become extinct or left Detroit. The corporate source of these jobs, citing a need to compete, search the globe for cheaper resources and increased profits. The city of Detroit and its surrounding areas now experience historical levels of poverty and homelessness. The economic and social conditions have provided people with two basic choices: suffer or suffer and fight. Two of the largest Detroit struggles are joblessness and the privatization of water. In today's show, we hear from two Detroit speakers. These two not only speak for social, political, and economic change, they fight for it in their communities. State Chairperson of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, Maureen Taylor, shares her community's struggles against the privatization of water in Detroit. In addition, we hear from retired auto worker General Baker giving a speech about Labor Day, unionism, and the labor movement. We begin with General Baker's speech, which was given at Detroit's Central United Church on September 5, 2004, the eve of Labor Day.
I think the famous statement goes something like this: those who refuse to study history forfeit their opportunity to learn from experience. So I think what we want to do here is learn from those historical things. On this occasion that Ed referred to, we're celebrating the sanctity of human labor. The first Monday in September, or Labor Day, was born in New York City. And from the historical records, it indicates that it was a call of Peter McGuire, an Irish-American cabinet maker and a leader of the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners in 1882. And in most of the rest of the world, May Day, or the 1st of May, is celebrated as a labor holiday out of the struggles for the 8-hour day in 1886. Both days were born on U.S. soil. One born and conceived in the question of rest, parade, and recreation, and the other conceived in the struggle and sacrifice and bloodshed. It's important, I think, that we hold on to the differences of these 2 days. One historical note on the battle for the 8-hour day in 1886 is that all of the early labor organizations could not lead a fight to shorten the work day in this country as long as chattel slavery existed in the South. And therefore, it was only after the Civil War that the rest of working people could stand up and fight to shorten their day after they had wiped out the institute that demanded that you had to work from can't see in the morning to can't see at night. That's an important thing I think we should know, because as long as there's a section of labor on the bottom that's destitute and almost in near slavery, the section of labor on the top cannot advance. And I think we should understand that as a principle from history. Now, Detroit's first Labor Day celebration took place actually on August the 16th, 1884. And it attracted 50,000 members of the Knights of Labor. The crowd of laborers marched proudly and defiantly down Woodward Avenue to a park, more than likely right past the Woodward Avenue doors of Central Church where we sit. The celebration was declared for two reasons. One, the first was a cause to exhibit to the public the strength and esprit de corps of the trade unions and labor organizations in the community. Then followed by a festive and recreational amusement for workers and their families. In today's world, some trade unions are beginning to polarize on this question. Some are choosing not to march, not to show their esprit de corps and their strength, but only want to divert to the festive activities that's supposed to have been the second part. There are other unions, though, that are pressing on with the precedent that was set 120 years ago. They are marching and then doing festive activities. I think, you know, we got to understand that Labor Day has also become a day where we summarize our experience and point the path for our future developments. And in that sense, we got to understand that we live in a very changing world. In a report that I got from David Apsey, Between 1995 and 2002, 33 million jobs were lost across the globe. And the country that lost the most jobs was China. So I don't want you to think that we got an easy way out, just thinking that if we stop the influx of jobs to China that we can save ourselves. It's deeper than that. A casual look, you know, as we try to understand this world, at CNN or Link TV, we see a world in turmoil. Ed was referring to so much of it earlier today. First and foremost is the war in Iraq that our government is waging on the Iraqi people. Secondly, the expansion of the 30-foot wall that was being built in Palestine that is 30 feet tall with barbed wire across the top and guard towers along the way. But the proposed expansion of that wall is supposed to be 425 miles long. Do you realize that's all the way from Detroit to Louisville, Kentucky? Workers in France in the streets fighting against an attempt to privatize the telephone industries. Workers in Germany fighting against a 20% cutback in welfare. And here at home, the picture is not that much different. Just look at the reports that came out just 1 week before the anniversary of Labor Day. On August the 27th, the reports that leaked out that poverty rose 12.5% last year. That the poverty rate is higher than it was in 1969. That the top one-fifth of the U.S. population earned 49.8% of the nation's wealth. That people without health insurance rose by 1.4 million just last year to a record 45 million. Michigan lost 170,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years. All of these factors are the effects of something. And we're not going to get by fighting the effects of something. I read a little book by a South African writer called Blame Me on History. And that was probably one of the little most important texts I ever read. Because he talked about how he spent 30 years fighting the effects of a thing before he found out and discovered that he really had to fight its cause. Now, therefore, so that we don't get caught fighting the effects, let's look at the causes. The changes that we're seeing going around us are global in nature and global in scope. Primarily, those forces are changing the technology, increasing productivity, and a pressure to drive down production costs. The resultant competition to drive down the labor costs and to maintain profits compels corporations and businesses to search for every possible new method to increase productivity by introducing more technology, forcing fewer workers to do more work, using an array of lean productions, intimidation and fear, or pursuing cheaper labor in other countries. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have assisted in global transformation through loans and forced austerity programs. Globalization and economic integration has transformed the societies and cultures all over the world. This phenomenon has led to the growth of megacities surrounded by widespread proliferation of slums. Millions populate these slums, no longer part of a formal economy of their country, and they are increasingly have no allegiance to any economic or political form. The most difficult problem that we can face with on this globe is the gap between poverty and wealth. Of the 6 million people that populate the globe, over half or 3 million supposedly live on an income of $2 a day. The gap between wealth and poverty is so great that it's become immoral. A similar dramatic shift in the United States is taking place, especially the shrinking of the working class. Over the past 4 decades, global changes tied to new technology and worldwide search for cheaper labor and increasing workload on fewer and fewer workers had led to layoffs and plant closing all over the USA. We've come to the end of an era. Just 2 weeks ago, unbeknownst to the news and the TV stations, the doors of Chevrolet Plant 4 in Cleveland closed. The last few workers marched out of that plant without any fanfare. Chevrolet Plant 4 in Flint was a home of the historic sit-down strike in 1937. Nothing more symbolic symbolizes the end of an era that we reached. And we all know about it here, right? We know all the plants that closed in front of us, and sometimes we forget. They closed Dodge, Maine. They closed Huber Avenue Foundry, Lynch Road Assembly, Jefferson North. They closed Cadillac, Fleetwood, Detroit Universal, the Michigan Casting Center. And the beat goes on and on and on. We even lost the icons that we used to worship. Werner's Ginger Ale, soaked in wood for 4 years, is gone from Woodward Avenue. Wonder Bread that made healthy bodies 12 ways Now sits a casino where people go in and try to gamble to try to save themselves from the depths of depression that we live with in this city. I think what we have to do is recognize and not get nostalgic thinking that these things are going to come back. They are gone. And let's figure out how to move on forward.
This is People's Tribune Radio. You're listening to a speech from retired auto worker General Baker. He is speaking about how globalization has changed Detroit, Michigan. He now begins to talk about the status of the union movement.
In a limited sense, I think we got to understand the union movement. And when I say union movement, I make a distinction between the union movement and the labor movement. Clearly, the union movement is only the organized portion of the labor movement. The labor movement, as our scripture pointed out to early, is all of those who work by the sweat of their brow. Whether you sell mental or physical labor, some get confused thinking that they're selling mental labor, they are not workers. Some selling mental or physical workers, whether you work in the countryside or in the city, whether you pay by the hour or all at once, whether you work part-time or half-time or not at all, if you once used to work and are no longer able, if you once used to work and now unemployed, if you wanted to work and can't get there, all of this represents the scope of the labor movement. And therefore, the union movement is only an organized portion, you know, of the labor movement. And I think when we stand here and talk to each other, we always like to address ourselves from the standpoint of the labor movement. Now, unionism is beginning to show some of its weaknesses. I said earlier that some of the unions don't even want to march no more. They're scared to flex their muscles and strut their stuff. I think they're afraid they may make somebody mad if they see the numbers that they have. But, you know, unions have historically fought for the increase in the wages and the improvement of working conditions that workers fought for. But the problem with that is that you always fought for one set of workers in one plant, in one industry. You were stuck there. Today, the tactics of the past are proving themselves ineffective. Unions can no longer get increases. Matter of fact, they go to the negotiating table, selling for losses. They go to the negotiating table and come back with a loss in health care benefits and a cutback in their pensions. Let me say that these tasks in front of us are not easy. Labor has a lot of difficulties. It needs a class party. It needs a party of people that's going to recognize all those that labor and not represent those that don't. We need a party that's going to stand up and not afraid of energizing its base. Why would these parties be afraid of energizing their base and go after the people that's so oppressed and free them up, you know, so they can get to the polls and bring the rest of society along with them? What is wrong with them today? But we need to understand that only by uniting with the goals of those on the bottom of society can we uplift the whole thing. On the question of solidarity, you know, the famous union song. And when I can understand from Elise Bryant, Solidarity Forever was adapted to the song that was formed by the soldiers leaving the battlefield in the Civil War. And if you notice, Solidarity Forever is to the same tune of a Battle Hymn of the Republic. And in the process of solidarity, I learned some things. And I gave this example once before because it's the most bitter one I learned in my life. It's an event that took place on October the 3rd, 1991, in a little city called Hamlet, North Carolina, at a factory called the Imperial Foods that produced chicken nuggets. And what happened on that September the 3rd, a fire broke out in that factory. And 25 workers died in that fire. When the word spread across the country, we all got angry and upset. We raised money at our local and our region, and we sent packages of money to the survivors of that. But that was not enough. Our anger had to take more of a direct affront. On May the 2nd of 1992, we organized 5 busloads of workers out of Region 5. We collected money, and we rode to Hamlet, North Carolina. We got there. It was a gruesome sight. We got a chance to go inside the factory, and we saw, you know, what used to be the refrigerators that became the tombs of most of those workers. You can see the flesh marks on the doors as they clawed and tried to get their way out. But the owner of the factory had chained all the doors shut because somebody was trying to steal his chicken nuggets. We marched through the streets of Hamlet that day. When we got to the rally at the park, it was a real spirited rally, but one of the most bitter lessons that we had to learn was out of the 25 workers that died in that factory, 13 were white and 12 were black. Not a single one of the white members of the white families showed up at that rally, even though the money was for everybody. And it was a bitter pill for us to swallow, you see. This question of solidarity is not an easy question. It got to be fought for. You see, the factory united them. The process of the production of chicken nuggets united them. The fire that broke out in that factory that day united them. The slow-handed death that touched 25 workers united them. But brothers and sisters, the streets divided them. When we raise our voice and sing solidarity, we got to fight to give that meaning. You know, the song says solidarity forever. It don't say solidarity for 8 hours. It don't say solidarity to the midnight hour in case you're working the second shift. That song says solidarity forever. And every time we raise it and fight for it, we got to fight to give that meaning. That's our message here today for you, brothers and sisters. I just appreciate this opportunity. Ed, I hope that the lesson is helpful, and I hope that we all learn from something, and I hope very well that I tried to give you some enlightenment this morning on this issue. Thank you.
You've been listening to People's Tribune Radio. Water for People, Not for Profit was a panel discussion that took place at the 2004 Boston Social Forum. We hear from State Chairperson of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, Maureen Taylor, who discusses Michigan's struggle against the privatization of water.
My name is Maureen Taylor. I'm the State Chairperson of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, and I bring you greetings from the National Welfare Rights Union. Production is what fuels society. All the time, it's always been that way. From the cotton gin, steam engines, electric engines, gas engines, gas generators, every kind of technology moves society ahead. And that movement is based on technology's ability to feed, house, clothe, provide health care, all the things that the society believe it needs. Things changed in about the early 70s with this. Can you see that? I know. It's a computer chip. And what it meant was, is that after they began to refine how to use this computer chip to replace labor, now we got something. There was a time that everybody in this room worked, and then all of a sudden, all of you all got laid off because there was technology created that could do your job. And only me and Ali, they kept on, and I was the daytime maintenance, and he was the nighttime maintenance, and all the rest of you lost your jobs. But it becomes important because you're going to be upset about breaking of this paradigm. The paradigm says you work, you get a check, you go out and you buy something, you become a consumer, all your money's gone, you go back to work again, get another check, consume, money's gone, and that's the cycle. Now what happens when that cycle is broken? Well, they know you're going to be upset, you're not going to just take this madness, lying down. So they have to create an entire propaganda set up to say that it's something wrong with you. You lost your job, you lost your experience, you lost your opportunity because of something you did. You're the wrong color, you're the wrong height, you're the wrong sex, you live in the wrong neighborhood, you married the wrong husband, you married the wrong wife, you're too tall, you're too short, your hair's not right. Something happened, and it became your fault for your poverty, for your circumstance. And even though it wasn't me and it wasn't Ali, we listened to that, and I said to him, Liz lost her job. And he says to me, yeah, but we found out that she was dating a Jewish guy. Oh, I guess that's why she lost her job. Oh, we found out she was dating a girl. We found out she was drinking. Oh, well, that makes sense. So therefore, we don't say anything when we clearly know that there's a problem. Now, I don't know what it is about poverty, what it is about poor people, why my constituents are so passive. Anything and everything can happen to us. And we know clearly that this crap is wrong, but we the last damn voice to talk about it. Rather than complain and organize and fight and resist, we'll take a second job and a third job. We'll allow for our water to be cut off. We'll get tubes and we'll get hoses and we'll run them from Arnie's house to Ruth's house. And we'll do everything rather than say, damn it, I'm one of God's children. I'm not going for this mess, not another damn minute. We're going to have water for everybody or nobody's going to have water. That seems to be the easiest way. But whatever it is, the Patriot Act, the Sixth Fleet, police brutality. There are all kinds of things that are put out here to try to convince us that the easiest thing to do is to suffer. We already had an excellent and a brilliant recitation by a person who is representing a part of that, and that's religion. Boy, the most crooked people on the face of this earth are those religious mother scrunches that'll tell you that it's better for you to pray on your knees and ask for God to solve your issues while you still die in poverty, while you still hungry, you have no water, but you waiting on Jesus, Muhammad, or someday somebody to ride down the street and save your crazy ass. And that's the way religion has been manufactured. It had turned into religious capitalism now. You know, where they just tell you, just pray and wait and pray and wait. Well, let me tell you what's happening in Detroit. Between June 1st of 2001 and June 1st of 2002, in one city in Detroit, Michigan, the water department disconnected service at 40,752 addresses. 40,752 addresses in 1 year. Unbelievable, the turmoil that this circumstance created. But it was only a turmoil when we found out about it in 2002. Because in 2001, when this atrocity was happening, the people were so shocked and hurt and frightened. In Michigan, if you have your water turned off, Family Independence Agency can find out about it. Me and Arnie married, we got three children. They find out we don't have any water, they'll bring the children away. Take them out of our household. We got three kids. They'll give one to Liz. They'll give a second one to Ali. They'll give a third to Ruth. And they'll pay each foster care parent $465 a month to raise our child. But they won't give us the money to keep our water on. I'm telling you, this is about money. These young ladies were correct. This is about capturing cash. That's all this is about. Now, the first stages, the attempts to be able to privatize water in Detroit has already started. You create this entire network, this propaganda that says poor people are worthless. They're black. They have babies out of wedlock. They have welfare recipients. They rather have welfare than work. They're lazy. They're trifling. They use drugs. They got all of these manifestations of bad social behavior. So anything that happens to my constituents, you better not say anything because we'll call you a welfare lover or something that sounds like that. So they create this mystique. So by the time they come and they turn our water off and everybody knows, people just sort of look at each other and wonder, well, you know, maybe I don't want to get involved because if I say something, you know, somebody might call me a water person, or somebody might call me a welfare lover, or maybe even worse than that, some kind of way I'll be held responsible or somebody will do something to me because I stood up for the right thing. The conditions are set all over the world for this kind of graft, for this kind of misery to be visited on millions of people. Now, this is a human rights violation, and nobody says anything about it. We do, but I'm talking to the converted in here. This is a human rights issue, but it's seen as a minority issue. That's why our comrade Ruth can suffer the way she suffered and her people suffering. Not a big thing, because we don't call it what it is. This is a poor people's issue, but we don't deal with this in the area of poverty. I had some folks research to me in the four books of the Bible, Mark, Luke, Matthew, and John, just those four, how many times Jesus Christ represented a comment about poverty. 2,013 times the man talked about it. It's the most talked about thing in the Bible. Should you think everybody who professes to be a Christian would be going that way? But no, 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 no. They got other agendas, other issues, other items. We got to stamp out people being gay. Jesus ain't said one damn word about that. Following a whole different pattern of activities. We got to fight this stuff over here. There's nothing in the Christian Bible that talks these things. I've gone through the Quran. I've gone through the Torah. None of those books talk about anything but how to be kind, how to help mankind, womankind, community, do for each other. But we are going down another kind of a path. You could not dare to capture and hold water as a hostage unless you prepare a path of extreme ignorance and visit that path on stupid white people, stupid black people, stupid Hispanics, stupid Native Americans, and whoever else that manages the society. You couldn't get away with this kind of nonsense unless you follow the Richard Pryor thought. Are you going to believe what I tell you, or are you going to believe your lying eyes? It's madness for us to continue to allow even water to be held hostage. If they can do this in Detroit, they've already done it in Nicaragua, and I'm certain that Detroiters are not being picked out because nobody necessarily hates us, but they need a place in which to start. This conference is good. This conference is extremely important, but it's still too much damn talking. I'm about wore out coming to all of these different parts of the country, and we talk about what we're going to do. We write about what we're going to do. We complete graphs, movies. We do the whole nine yards. We got to get out. This can no longer be an armchair fight. If we're going to deal with taking water back, you're going to have to take water back everywhere. Now, I'm not suggesting that people go all the way to Nicaragua. We're too far. You can't come to Detroit because we can't save you. We have to figure out how to save this ourselves. But you need to be making this fight where you are to make certain that whatever it is being visited on my community, it doesn't come to yours. We either have to get on the pot and make it pass, or we have to go away. Greetings once again from Michigan Welfare Rights.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. We would like to thank David Apsey for providing us with General Baker's speech and Radio Free Maine's Roger Leisner for Maureen Taylor's panel discussion. PT Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society, where the plenitude science makes possible ensures the material, intellectual, cultural, and spiritual growth of everyone. If you would like to share some of your comments, order some of our other print and media resources, or receive a list of our speakers, you may do so by calling our 800 number, 1-800-691-6888. Once again, that number is 1-800-691-6888. Also, you can visit us on the web at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, thanks for listening to the show, and please tune in next time for People's Tribune Radio.